Chapter 19. Aftermath. The city began to recover. The wail of a thousand sirens called across the night as Sally, Patrice and Mook wandered out of the alleyway, dazed and shaken, wondering about everyone they knew, their mates, their families, Mickey and Rose. All three tried their phones, but the networks were down. They looked towards Old Compton Street. Dummies lay on the ground alongside the dead, but then movement. Survivors, calling out in pain or relief, some staggering along, some sitting against walls, wounded, lost, in shock. "Bandages," said Sally, "and water and painkillers. Come on." She strode towards Oxford Street to find a chemist's or a supermarket with a pharmacy. The shops had been abandoned in the panic, so they'd just walk in and raid the place. No time for niceties. People needed help. As they hurried along, she saw that Mook was still holding Patrice's hand. About time, she thought. Everything had changed that night, and perhaps it was time she made some changes herself. She should go home to see her mum and dad. She should talk to them. She should tell them more about herself and the Stephen who once was. Maybe she could even move back in for a while. The anger that had propelled her out of the house and into her new life seemed so much smaller now, so unimportant. And one more thing, she took hold of Mook's free hand and made a decision on behalf of the Bad Wolf Band. "It's the name," she said. "We've got to change the name." Caroline stayed on the floor, hugging Ben and Michael. Both boys crying out of shock, she supposed, doubting they yet understood what had happened to their father. She wondered how to tell them. And there she remained, in the middle of a thousand dummies' heads. She could hear people sobbing and others shouting, asking if anyone needed help. Someone even began to sing, "Rule Britannia." She stayed on the tarmac, even as blue emergency lights began to flicker at the end of the road. A camera crew ran up, fixed their ruthless lens upon her, ran away. Throughout all this, Caroline thought of one person. She thought of the doctor. She'd listened to Clive's stories. She'd read his files. She knew that every age had some sort of doctor, whether young or old, male or female, in between or neither, black or white or anything, and the doctor invited disaster. Every single one of her husband's stories said the same thing. Death stalks the doctor, and anyone who crosses the doctor's path. Which meant everything was the doctor's fault. Sitting there, on the floor, holding her sons in the ruins of a broken city, Caroline Finch made a promise. Somehow, someday, she would complete her husband's lifelong quest and find this mysterious doctor. And then, she would have her revenge. Jackie was desperate, thinking of Rose. Her phone wouldn't work. The networks had given up the ghost, but she kept trying again and again until she exhausted the battery and her handset died. She kept walking, heading for home. All around her, horrors, injuries that made her flinch. People lying on the floor, asking for help, huddled in corners, crying, lost children. But Jackie didn't have time. She had to get back to the flat to find Rose. She'd been in that flat so many years ago when the terrible news came about Pete. She had to be there now to stop that news from ever coming again. And then her mobile rang, which was odd because it was dead. The power bar still said zero as the screen blinked back into life to say, "Rose." Jackie answered, "Oh my God, sweetheart, is that you? Are you all right?" Rose's voice was so clear it startled her. "Never mind me, what about you?"
"Honestly, trust me, I'm fine."
"Where are you?" A pause.
"Travelling,"
said Rose. "What the hell does that mean?"
"Never mind, I'm on my way home."
Rose's voice became muffled as she asked someone,
"How long?"
Then she came back to Jackie.
"I'm 1 second away, apparently."
"I'm still up west. Did you see it? All the dummies, and not just people dressed up. Their heads fell off. I picked up this bride's head and I gave it a tap and it was solid. Then I banged it on the floor and I'm telling you, 100% plastic. It was moving and they tipped over a bus and killed this man right in front of me. You should have seen it. And this great big clown."
"Yeah, sorry, gotta go."
And click, Rose was gone. Oh, well, thank you, madam, said Jackie to her phone. But Rose was alive. Her daughter was safe and heading home. Jackie would get there somehow. Even if she had to walk all the way, she'd burst through that door. She'd get out the whiskey. She'd knock them up a curry. She'd toast their survival and hold her daughter tight. Hey, she might even sell her story for a bit of money. My Night of Hell by Jacqueline Tyler. But first of all, she thought of the children she'd walked past. And Jackie went back to help. Rose held up her mobile and said to the doctor, Best reception ever. She sounded louder than she does in real life. And for my mother, that's saying something. Did you give my signal a boost? The TARDIS might have helped, said the doctor, with a smile. He moved around the central console, attaching one switch to another with the sort of elastic rope you'd use on a roof rack. The glass column sighed up and down above their heads, the engine noise reduced to a slow groan, the room tilting and swaying, but gently this time. Rose said, Could I phone Miles from here? Yeah. Tell them I want my boots back. Why, what happened to your boots? I left them there, obviously. Even when joking, he was still so rude. Mickey interrupted. How do we get out of here? He was sitting on the floor, on the opposite side of the console to the doctor, determined to stay as far away from him as possible. He'd initially retreated down one of the gantries, so scared of the chamber's size that he'd tried to hide in the shadow of an internal doorway. But then he'd heard a roar from the depths of the TARDIS. That'll be the dragon, said the doctor, and Mickey had scarpered back to the centre. Now he huddled into himself, miserable, smeared with grease and grime. As far as he knew, the police box was still inside the underground lair. He could accept that the interior was calmer somehow, safer and sort of detached, but he had no concept of the box having moved. Rose supposed she could explain it to him, but later, maybe. The doctor was more important right now. Time with him was precious. He could vanish on a whim. So what are we now? She said to the doctor. I mean, like this, right now, what are we doing? Are we in flight? Sort of, yeah. But in flight where? Like I said, 1 second away. But it's taking more than a second, Rose said. So while we're in flight, we're not flying like a plane. So where are we? Mickey said, What the hell are you on about? But the doctor had a wolfish gleam in his eye, a challenge. He strode down the entryway, those big boots making the metal clatter and clang to reach the wooden doors. He said, Do you really want to see? Rose said, Yeah, and smiled, returning the challenge. He opened the left-hand door. She looked at the view and took a good few seconds to accept it, to consider the angle and the depth and the likelihood and the sheer, oh my God, sight of it. And she wanted to yell and run away and hide. But then she did what she was dying to do, and she went to stand at the doctor's side. They were in flight above the earth. She stood on the edge of the rickety wooden box, and below, there was the entire planet. She held the whole of the world within her sight. It's a trick. That's not real, said Mickey. But she didn't even look round. She heard a clang of metal. Mickey sitting back down and burying his head, she guessed. But she stayed in the doorway looking out at the universe. She wondered, with the door open to space, how can we breathe? But in the same moment, she thought, well, we can, so therefore it's possible. Simple as that. She could trust herself to work things out, and she smiled, thinking of everyone who'd ever doubted her, now so tiny, trapped by gravity far below while she sailed on high. She looked down at Great Britain, the lights of London, a yellow sprawl in the dark of night. Down there, she supposed, there must be fires and alarms and tragedies, but it seemed mercilessly peaceful from above. She looked to her left, the clouds of the Atlantic curling towards a bright fringe of sunlight, the long day ending beyond the curve. Then she looked up and out at the infinite stars. She had imagined space as a simple black, but it was paler and richer and so much more complex, infused with extraordinary maroons, reefs of light blue, glints of yellow on vast clouds of the deepest green. They stood there together, Rose and the doctor, in an intimate silence. Then she looked at the northeast curve of the horizon below, some plains of Russia, focusing on particular dips of landscape. She waited, and then, as she knew she would, she saw them change under the planet's slow revolve. "I can feel it," she said. "The turn of the Earth." He smiled. They stayed there for a while. Then she stepped back and the doctor closed the door. It was time to go home.